That's the Spencer Davis Group escorting us into the second half of tonight's program. My thanks to our earlier guest, Jim Mars. One of Jim's colleagues in the study of the JFK assassination is my next guest. His name is John Barber. And if you lived in the L.A. area, you've certainly seen him on television. He was very well known. He also is regarded as the godfather of reality TV for a show he created called Real People years ago. He's the only performer to win in television to win Emmys for both entertainment and news. He was a caustic critic. If you ever see those late night commercials for the Dean Martin roast, you would have seen him on that as well. He was one of the roasters and helped write a lot of that material. A famous guy who was on top of his game until he got interested in the JFK assassination, and then things came tumbling down. We're going to get into the very compelling story, life story of John Barber, as well as some pretty fascinating research and things that he's uncovered. He's been in contact with the Kennedy family in recent times, and he has some new interesting information he's developed about who gave the actual order to take out JFK. In a moment, my guest, John Barber, here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the program, a guy I've got to know a little bit over the last couple of years and greatly enjoy his company, John Barber. John, great to have you on the show.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you, George, again. And it was wonderful listening to you talking to Jim and Jim telling his stories. And I'm such an admirer of yours because you're one of the few hosts I know who actually reads the books of the guests that he has on. But you said something to, and it was kind of a sad throwaway by you to Jim, and you said, if I'm phrasing this properly, you said to him, well, when somebody becomes president, do people go in there and sit down and have a come to Jesus moment with them? And you sounded kind of sad when you said that. But that reminded me, do you recall a comedian named Bill Hicks?
Yeah, sure.
Bill Hicks would have been bigger than Lenny Bruce, and he would have been bigger than George Carlin. He died, unfortunately, when he was 33 of cancer. There have only been three great jokes, I think, ever written about the assassination. He wrote two of them, and I wrote one. But when you said that, it reminded me of a joke in his act. He said, folks, you know, when the president is elected, the first thing that happens is that the heads of the CIA and the Pentagon chiefs come into the Oval Office, and they turn on the television set, and they show the new president a film of John Kennedy being shot from another angle. And that is so brilliant. The other joke that he wrote was that he went to the sixth floor of the Texas Book Depository, and he visited it, and he said it was so realistic. And he said, you know why it was realistic? Oswald wasn't even there. So that reminded me of Bill and the joke that I tried to tell on the Dean Martin show back in 1967, which got almost a standing ovation. I had to cut out of the show. But, you know, Jim said something to the effect that today 85% of all Americans do not believe that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone or even did it at all. Well, back in 1970, when I tried to first book Jim Garrison on my AM show in Los Angeles after reading Heritage of Stone, which I happened to read by accident, by the way, we had the same conversation, and he pointed out that the Harris poll said that 83% did not believe at that time in 1970 that Oswald acted alone or he must have had co-conspirators or that he didn't do it at all. But what they don't tell you is that in the Harris poll, only 23% never wanted a new investigation. So I said to Mr. Garrison, that says, I know what my mother and father did to conceive me, but don't you dare tell me that my mother's not a virgin. Americans, people in general, are herd animals. And herd animals need leaders. All herds have leaders. They have eliminated from John Kennedy to Malcolm X to Martin Luther King all of our leaders. They have eliminated all of them. And you said something again, that made me feel kind of sad. You said, gee, Jim, isn't there any hope that this will ever be resolved? And Jim said, well, there are more of us than there are of them, which may be true. But they own the means of communication. And when do you think, George, that America came close to perhaps resolving the issue of who murdered John Kennedy?
The House Assassinations Committee was making some progress,
That's
I think.
That's exactly right. It was the formation of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And why do you think they formed this committee? What compelled them to form that committee?
I don't remember. It could have been an outgrowth of was it the Church Committee or the RFK assassination?
I point out about the Church Committee, because back in the 70s, Frank Church, in his hearings into the Central Intelligence Agency, revealed that the CIA in the mid-1970s had 1,000 assets working for all the major media, the three major networks at the time, Time Life, and newspapers, radios, books, publishing, everything. They named and printed 1,000 names. That was in 1970. What do you think the CIA owns today? This country is no longer symbolized by the three letters of the alphabet USA. It is CIA. What prompted the growth of the House Select Committee and assassinations was Dick Gregory appearing late night with Geraldo Rivera and showing the Zapruder film.
Oh.
They received hundreds of thousands of letters. So Congress had no choice but to respond to the public pressure. None of this pressure came from politicians. None of this pressure came from the media. It came from the public's outrage at the airing of the Zapruder film, showing that it was obvious that John Kennedy's head was blown backwards. And it was obvious that when it was reported to us by the newscaster, oh, God, what's the guy that became the $6 million man? The guy who was there.
Dan Rather? Or who
Dan
do you mean?
Rather. He was an ordinary field reporter when he went on the air to report that Kennedy's head is being shot. And he said he described everyone's clothing, everything in the car to a deal, everything, the pink suit that the First Lady was wearing, her pillbox hat, the hat of the Stetson and Connolly's hand, everything. Except he says, now I have to pause the film because it's too violent to show you. And he demonstrates how the head is being thrown forward. So now the American people know by the millions that it is all an absolute lie.
Well,
now, what happens? Have you ever heard of a guy named Richard Sprague?
Sure. He was he a senator from Pennsylvania?
Richard Sprague was a tough prosecutor from Philadelphia who had sent a lot of leading politicians, mafia people, and teamsters to jail. And he was selected as the first counsel to the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And at his very first meeting, he draws up this memo. He has a dozen of his hired staff in front of him, and he stands up, and guess what the first thing he said to them is? Now, you can't guess, so I'll tell you. He says, none of you is to hire anybody associated with the FBI or the CIA because they're on the top of the list to be investigated. Shortly thereafter, he gets a call from Arlington or Langley, and is told to come over to CIA to be interviewed. I think Stanfield Turner was the head of the CIA at the time. He says, no, you come over here to be interviewed, and on your way over, fill up a panel truck with a lot of your documents. The CIA then use their congressional assets, and don't think they have bunches of them there, and their media assets, and they have hundreds of them there, to get rid of Richard Sprague. And guess what they charged him with? They charged him with trampling on people's rights. He hadn't even started his investigation. And guess when the CIA ordered their media assets and they sent people to infiltrate Garrison's investigation from 67 to 69, the media said Garrison is trampling on people's rights, which he wasn't doing. But that's the way they got rid of Sprague. And guess who they hire? They hire a guy named Robert Blakey, a Columbia law professor who goes to Langley and is interviewed, and hires a couple of dozen CIA agents to help investigate the case. Now, at the time, Jim Garrison, on the request of Richard Sprague, turns over a lot of his documents so they'll have stuff to work with. As soon as he heard that Blakey was hired, he refused to testify, and he told me it's over. And indeed, it was over. And Robert Blakey is the guy that invented the myth about the mafia doing it. And if you buy his book, on the very front page, it's dedicated to the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, last year, on the 50th anniversary of the assassination, one of the leading assassination sites, something called ARC, they invite Robert Blakey to speak. And they turn me down to talk about Jim Garrison. And I sent them a back a note saying inviting Robert Blakey to speak is like inviting him to be the chef at the Last Supper. The guy is an asset, for crying out loud. Anyway, I didn't mean to get carried away on that. And then also you mentioned that Jim went to 25 publishers before he could publish his book. You know the book that opened the can of worms of what a basket and bundle of garbage and lack of investigation the Warren Report was, as you know, was Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment. Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment was published in 1966. You may recall, but you're probably just a kid at the time, but I recall that everybody was attacking Mark Lane as being a money grubber and creating a cottage industry about questioning the government and the Warren Report. But guess what? 120 publishers in America turned the book down. It was published in England, and Mark only got $1,500, for crying out loud.
I was going to say that if we're talking about media control and a retribution from media, I mean, you're an example of it. You were flying pretty high. You were making money. You were famous. You had big stars for friends and colleagues. And then you got hooked on the Jim Garrison story and things came tumbling down.
Well, you know something? A Civil War soldier said, you know, I never got anything that I prayed for in my life, but I got everything that I needed. And I feel the same way about my trying to tell Jim Garrison's story. Now, it started 44 years ago, but the truth is, it was just an accidental byproduct, you know? And speaking of accidents, I found, George, maybe you have too, that the best things in life really only happen by accident. Well, the disasters are always well-planned. I mean, the Vietnam War was well planned. Obamacare was well planned. The recent Democrats' re-election victory was well planned. But Snowden leaving America revealing NASA's spying was an accident. And quite honestly, my son was an accident. And my mentor when I started in this business was Red Fox, believe that or not. And Red always used to say, it was one of my favorite lines, he said, "Heroes ain't born, they're cornered." Well, Jim Garrison was cornered by reluctantly getting involved with the assassination because he first believed the Warren Report until Hale Boggs, it was actually Hale Boggs, he says in the documentary that it's Senator Long that questioned, was one of the dissenting voices in the Warren Commission, but it was actually Hale Boggs. And by that time, Garrison, you know, he thought, you mean that because Hale Boggs said to him, "I'm a hunter. I'm telling you, that old man, Looker Carcano, couldn't shoot a rabbit." And Garrison said, "You mean?" And Boggs said, "You mean?" Now, strangely enough, Hale Boggs disappeared in an airplane crash.
Yeah.
And was never found. His daughter, though, became quite successful in television. So Jim went out and got three sets of the Warren Report. He had one in the car, he had one in the office, and one at home. And practically memorized it all. And it was only by accident that I happened to get involved with Garrison. But truth was, in 1963, when Kennedy was shot, I was 30 years old. I had absolutely no interest in the fact that the president was shot, even though I found him immensely charming and immensely witty. And the reason I liked him, I was able to write a lot of great jokes about him. I felt really bad because I'd lost half of my act. But worse than that, Von Meter, who had the greatest comedy album in history called First Family, which you may remember, he lost his entire act. I mean, if you Google that First Family album, listen to some of it, you'll wonder. It sold millions. It was just terrific. But these assassination sites, I am going next week, November 22nd, I'm going to speak at my one and only time at one of these JFK hearing things.
Why one and only?
Because I believe they're mostly a waste of time. Every November forever since the assassination, there have been meetings held in New York and in Pittsburgh and New Orleans and in Dallas. And a number of the people who go there are brilliant researchers, and three of them happen to be my best friends in that community. That's Dick Russell and Joan Mellon and Jim Mars. And Jim Mars is featured prominently in the Garrison tapes, and in The Last Word in the Assassination, which we did in January at UNLV, he and Joan Mellon and Dick Russell, they make an enormous contribution to the documentary and Jim Garrison's story, because I didn't believe anybody could follow that wonderful documentary, but they enhance it. Now, in spite of the fact that I admire these people, I have 400 books, and I've read them all. I've memorized most of them. But if all of these people spoke as one, a chorus of one, they wouldn't make as much noise or as much sense as a solitary voice of Jim Garrison. On November 22nd, there is going to be what is considered a moment of silence in Dallas. As sympathetic as I am to the people participating in that, it's just a feel-good moment for those people. We don't need a moment of silence. We've had 50 years of silence from the federal government. What we need, George, is a moment, a strong moment, months of moments of absolute outrage. Now, there are a number of these sites, and they have these gatherings and brilliant people speaking, as I've said. There is not one person who will ever discover a document proving that the Central Intelligence Agency murdered John Kennedy. And in 2037, when the CIA and the government are supposed to release all these documents, I guarantee you the Central Intelligence Agency won't release anything. It'll be totally black and redacted. So they're assembling at these sites is an absolute total waste of time. But I will tell you this. If you look at the Warren Report just by itself, there is enough obstruction of justice by the federal government, by Lyndon Johnson, by the FBI, and by the CIA, and by probably 20 members of the media to bring criminal charges for obstruction of justice. Now, I'm sure that you have watched 2020, or have you watched 48 Hours, and it's a murder mystery, but there's no body found, but they still convict somebody.
Right. I'll tell you what, John, I have to take a break here. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're going to take a break. We'll come right back and let you finish that thought. This is Dream Academy, a song that always makes me think of JFK. It's called Life in a Northern Town. Stay with us. There's a reason I'm playing that song, High Hopes by Frank Sinatra. It was a hit for Sinatra in 1959, but he rewrote the lyrics to be played at the JFK inaugural, and the song is sort of synonymous with the Camelot era. It would ring a bell for anybody who was alive and remembers that song. My guest, John Barber, certainly remembers it and remembers that era. He was on top of the world, and his interest in the JFK assassination helped to bring him down. He's produced two excellent programs. One is a documentary film called The Garrison Tapes, the definitive examination of Jim Garrison, who was a central figure in the investigation of the assassination. And then another more recent program, The Last Word on the Assassination, which is includes the documentary and a discussion with a number of experts, including Jim Mars and John Barber. And we've got links to those programs if you want to check them out. We continue our conversation right after this on Coast to Coast AM. John Barber, I want to take another run at this question. I posed it earlier, and we sort of got sidetracked. But, I mean, do you attribute some of what happened to your career, to your interest in JFK? I mean, am I overstating it that you were kind of on top of the world?
Oh, I was in three instances. First, I had the most successful morning show in Los Angeles, the AM show. We were bumping heads with the Today Show in just 3 or 4 months, and that's where I earned my first Emmy. I was the first one to review movies and television on a news show in America. You know, now they're as common as weather people. And people would come on my show and ask, not only did we report the news, we made news. Now, people don't remember. Muhammad Ali is a hero now. But back then, 91% of Americans wanted him in jail because he wouldn't go to Vietnam and kill yellow people because he said they weren't as harmful to him as white people. They wanted Hanoi Jane Fonda locked up. She came on our show. Cesar Chavez came on our show. We made news. It was a phenomenal show until I booked Jim Garrison. I lost that. Then Real People was the first reality show I created in 79, and I wrote and edited almost all of the hours for the 3 years that I was there. It used to get a 50 share in Chicago in the Midwest. It got higher shares than I Love Lucy, a MASH, All in the Family. It's almost never mentioned now. We got 25,000 pieces of mail a week, and because of what something happened and somebody literally libeling on NBC, Jim Garrison and my confronting them cost me that show. At the time, I was getting $22,000 an hour, $11,000 for a rerun. That's $33,000. And then I lost the opportunity to do the most phenomenal visual autobiography ever of a performer, of Francis Sinatra, whom I accidentally, there you go, by accident again, befriended when I was one of the four writers on the Laugh-In Revival in 1977, and for 5 years became his joke writer, his letters to the editor writer, some of which show up in Kitty Kelly's book, My Way, and I lost that because of assassination stuff. But when you started playing that song, I started laughing because I thought it was your way of telling me that I was the little ant with high hopes.
No.
Well,
no, I was just setting the stage.
I thought it was totally charming because let me tell you what I think November 22nd should be. November 22nd should become America's Bastille Day, where we storm the bureaucratic barricades at the Justice Department and the White House, demanding that they free the truth, which they know they have, and we know they have it locked up. And the only people who could do that are the heads of all these gatherings, which gather separately every year. They should dispense with that, join forces for a once-a-year massive Martin Luther King-like march on Washington. And I'm telling you something, George, that's the only way it could happen. And if they don't do that and dispense with these nonsensical, meaningless gatherings, then they are continuing to do just what the government and the CIA wants them to do, which is Bob Dylan's song, Blowing in the Wind. Now, there are going to be 30 terrific speakers where I'm going, and I'm going to try to listen to the half of them because there's a lot of new stuff that I could learn. But I am not in their league as a researcher or a scholar. I mean, I know as much as most of them. What I am primarily, George, is a storyteller. So I'm going there to tell Jim Garrison's story and a little bit about the storyteller, which is me. I mean, how could somebody like myself ever end up in the position of having this story in my hands and feeling compelled to tell it? So I'll tell you honestly, for years after the killing, I truthfully was only mildly interested in reading about the assassination and trying to tell Jim's story. I was still trying to earn a living, but that's not what I wanted to be in life. And you know what I wanted to be. You know, you have a lot of shows about the occult and the metaphysical and spiritualism and stuff like that. And I listen frequently because I'm interested in that. But I'm a huge fan of yours, so I listen. But I don't believe any of it. But after my dealings with Robert Kennedy Jr. last January and trying to mount something for the 50th anniversary to sort of balance the barrage of crap dumped on us by the media, I feel somehow that my life, if there is a purpose in my life, it is to try to tell Jim Garrison's story. Now, in spite of all the stuff that I've lost, I would continue to do it because it is so rewarding, feeling I have something meaningful and something the truth. Now, I lost all of that, but when there were times when I wanted to tell the story and couldn't, for example, after getting fired from my show, Real People, the only person who would talk to me was Sinatra because we were getting ready to do his autobiography, which fell apart when more assassination stuff turned up, which I'll get to later. But I had no way of getting the money to do it. And one of my favorite writer philosophers is Joseph Campbell. He always said, if you follow your joy, doors will open that you didn't even know exist, as if by magic. It's happened three times in my life when I ran into a total dead end and trying to tell Jim Garrison's story. That was one time. Where am I going to get $200,000 now to tell Jim's story? And then when no one, absolutely no one, after we made the documentary and it won the San Sebastian Film Festival Award, Werner Herzog invited us to Vienna. It's a huge hit around the world. We get a standing ovation at the Santa Monica Film Festival. For a week, there's standing room only at the Lemley Theater in Los Angeles. The LA Times shows up uninvited, writes this rave review. It's a slam dunk to make $1 million easily if you just book it across a street from Oliver Stone's JFK. Nobody will distribute it. Nobody will put it on television. So it literally disappeared. Now, guess what? I move up here 20 years ago to Las Vegas, and again, as if by magic, somebody literally knocks on my door. I have a friend named David Shulman who said, play golf with him. He sells steel to the Chinese, so he's rich. And he says to me, John, you read everything. Why don't you have a computer? I said, I've just mastered the Underwood, for crying out loud. He said, I'm getting you a computer. So he got me a computer. I never wanted one. He sends a computer over with a young man named David Lispy. Good-looking, muscular young guy. He comes to the door, he looks at me, he said, hey, you're John Barber. And I say, yeah. And I thought, well, maybe he recognized me because I was on the air and L.A. and I had Real People. I was a film critic for L.A. Magazine for 10 years. Maybe you recognize that. And I said, what do you recognize me from? He said, my professor in history class used to play your Garrison tapes every month and say, that's all you need to know about the assassination. And I said, you're kidding. He said, yeah. He said, you should put it up on your site. I don't have a site. He said, I'll build you one. I said, listen, David, I can't afford you. He said, I'll do it for nothing. So he put the site up for nothing, which became John Barber's World. And guess what I do is I put it up, and in a year, it's had about 18,000 hits. Nobody knows about it. And so I've mastered the computer to the point that I know what Wikipedia means, and I look up the 12 leading assassination sites. I send them a link to the Garrison tapes and a letter saying, this is free. Would you put it up on your sites? The most important voice, the only law enforcement officer to ever investigate this case, put it up on your site for nothing so more people could see it. Not one of those assassination sites put it up. I got one nasty letter from a woman. And so it disappears. And guess what? Every year, November 22nd, I'm mailing it off to every network, every talk show host. And then finally, one day, I'm sitting down, and I loved your local newscast. And I thought, that guy is really good. Maybe I'll just send it to him as an afterthought. And you saw it. You liked it. You put me on the air. 50,000 people saw that the very next year. Now, you would think that would be enough for all these assassination sites to now put it up for nothing. Let me tell you something. When Kennedy was talked into going into Cuba by the CIA and Alan Dulles, and it failed, he fired Alan Dulles and his associate, a guy named Cabell, whose brother happened to be the mayor of Dallas when they were planning the route. Okay, so he's gone. Now, he's killed. And who does Lyndon Johnson appoint to investigate through supposedly the war report? Alan Dulles. The Central Intelligence, you know, you and Jim were talking about, almost talking about how corporations run America. It is absolutely true that leading social scientists at the five leading universities back east said America is no longer a democracy. You probably read it. It's an oligarchy.
Yep.
It's a kleptocracy. Now, the Supreme Court has ruled that corporations are people. Well, if people commit crimes, they go to jail. You tell me, George, why the president of General Motors, who knew that she knew her automobiles were killing people on the street, why is that lady not in jail? It is not a penalty for those people to pay a fine. They should be in jail. The people from 2008 who caused me and millions of others to lose their homes, those people should be in jail. And who are the guardians of the corporation? The Central Intelligence Agency are their hitmen. I mean, America's gotten so dumbed down. I'll tell you, I tried to become a citizen when I was 16. Oh, I'm going to put that on hold for a minute. You may want to ask a question, but I'm going to go back to the beginning about how does somebody like this end up with this massive story in his hand, not knowing quite what to do with it? You know, I did not want to do that at all. I wanted to be Jack Parr. You might remember Jack Parr. I wanted to be Jack Parr when I was a kid. Now, listen, I came from a severely, severely dysfunctional family long before it was popular. When I was 11, George, I spent months going to church and reading the Bible and praying that my father, who'd run away to the peace and quiet of World War II, might come home. Or that my mother would quit bringing home drunken uncles who beat her bloody in the middle of one sermon with no prayers being answered, and today no texts are being answered. I walked out of the church and put down the Bible for the last time, became a non-believer, and I sat on the steps, and I remember it vividly. I was afraid to go home. When the service was over, the minister came out, and he put his arm around me, and I almost started to cry because it was the first time I had ever been hugged. And he said, John, do you believe in God's will? And George, I looked up at him and I said, and I don't know where it came from. I said, I don't know. I've never read it. That sort of became the defense mechanism for my pain, which was my smart mouth. Okay, so now I'm 15. Okay. We had, well, it happened a little, we had a teacher, an extremely, extremely fat, cruel teacher in our history class. And you didn't often see fat people in Canada back in those days. You didn't see them anywhere in those days. Now all you have to do is go to Walmart and it's flooded with them. But it was an anomaly, as you said to Jim earlier, to see a fat person. Anyway, he was cruel. He would beat us with rulers and sticks and whack us on the head when he shuffled down the aisle. And one day, he leans against his, he comes in and he's moaning and groaning. All we ever heard about was him. He's leaning against his desk. And he says, "My ankles are swollen." I thought I said it under my breath, but it was out loud. I said, "How can you tell?" Anyway, he dragged me to the principal's office and beats my hand bloody with a steel strap, okay? I walked out of school. I never went back. I was 15. I hopped on a train, a boxcar, and I went to California by train. And the reason I went there, when I spent my days alone in the theater, at the end of the movie, it said "Made in California." And that's where I wanted to be. The movies made me company. So I get into a small boarding house. It's at La Brea and Hollywood Boulevard. I am barely 16 years of age, and I get all kinds of odd jobs. And I'm hoping and praying now to become a part of what kept me company, which was movies and television, again, especially Jack Parr. And the reason for that was that Jack Parr had conversations with people. I could not believe you could earn a living, as you do, having conversations with people. I'd never heard a conversation in my house. Just screaming. Well, one day, I get into an argument with a young Republican. He's an accountant, and he was talking about Canada's health care program, which I didn't know anything about, but I defended it because you could get free medical care in Canada. He called the FBI. The FBI came to the door looking for John Barber. Well, I heard them, so I ran upstairs and jumped out the back window into the arms of six more FBI agents. They had sent eight of these guys in suits for this 16-year-old. Well, I'm allowed one phone call. I call my mother, and I ask for $40 because that would pay the bus fare for a voluntary departure. And she turns me down. I never spoke to or saw my mother ever again. And they send me to a place called Terminal Island in San Pedro for 6 months. Well, I'm not going to stay locked up for 6 months. It's going to drive me nuts. So two Mexicans, a guy in charge of the laundry, agree to help me escape by sending me down the laundry chute. So for weeks, George, I case the place, and I find out that the security is really lax because when people come during the week, the gates are open, the doors are open, so I figured the middle of the week, Wednesday, would be perfect. So anyway, on a Wednesday on the third floor, they stick me in the chute. I go down. I land in a pile of laundry. I'm wearing my one ragged suit. I rush to the door to open it and run out, and it's locked. I try again. It's locked. I try every door. There are three doors down there, all locked. And I kept trying and kept trying, and they're all locked. I got so tired, I fell asleep. And I'm awakened by immigration officers after they take the count. So they sentenced me to a couple of more months. And I'm 16 years of age, and they put me in chains to send me out of the country. But anyway, while they were questioning me, I said, "Can I ask you guys a question?" And they said, "What is it?" I said, "How come the doors are all locked on Wednesday?" And they started howling, and they said, "It's July 4th. So I made up my mind, George, I was going to learn American history. Anyway, I go back to Canada. I got no future. The reason I didn't become another teenage suicide, and believe me, it crossed my mind for a few minutes, was that nobody would miss me. So what I decided to do, I was the only thing I could hope for.
John, we need to take a break. When we come back, I want to veer it a little back toward the JFK story. We'll let you wrap up this your fascinating review of your personal history, and then we'll get back to JFK. Allman Brothers take us into the break. Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast.